Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're going on a summer road trip. Our Struggle to Stay series continues as we catch up with Mark Combs on his journey to find a home outside of West Virginia.
It's been kind of tough, to be honest. I didn't think I would miss people back home this much.
Moving away isn't easy. We'll talk with a musician who moved to Nashville, but admits it has been difficult to settle into a bigger city.
You know, it was the first time I lived in a city. I didn't have any money. I didn't know that many people.
And we'll travel back to the 1950s to hear about a summer camp in East Tennessee that allowed racial integration long before schools were integrating.
These walls of separation are coming down, and you see an experiment going forward. So I think it had a ripple effect.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Summer is often a time for road trips. So we put together a few stories that made us think of summer break. And we'll also explore how two of Appalachia's biggest industries have changed over time and why some former coal miners are looking for jobs in the solar industry. But we'll start off today with our next installment of The Struggle to Stay. We continue this week with our series following actor and Iraqi war veteran Mark Combs and his good friend and artist Cameron Elias Williams. These young men took off from West Virginia hoping to land on their feet in Los Angeles, the land of supposed abundant creative jobs from their economically depressed home in Appalachia. But they found the dream life in L.A. was a little harder to grasp than expected.
You know, everybody you talk to is like, oh yeah, there's a bunch of places over here to rent, there's a bunch of places over there to rent, but there's really not.
Now they've retreated to Colorado. In this next story, Glynis Board shares why they ventured to Colorado and what they found when they arrived.
Mark and Cameron didn't expect to have to spend so much money when they got to California. They didn't expect to be headed to Denver a week later. And they certainly didn't expect that Denver would push them to breaking points either. Life's full of surprises. But let's catch up. When we last heard from them...
Surprise! We're in Denver. Mile High City. So, basically, Los Angeles didn't work out. Yeah, it didn't work out this time around. We're gonna reposition ourselves and come back stronger and better, I guess you could say.
Right.
Mark and Cameron got to California in September and left 7 days later, several grand poorer.
You know what? I don't really think it really crossed our minds that, yeah, Cameron and I weren't necessarily, rolling in the money in West Virginia, but we weren't doing bad. But that still meant we were poor as f*** on LA standards.
A guy came into the store today, and he was from LA, and he was talking about one of his friends that pays $2,500 for a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood. And I can guarantee you that house didn't come with a damn refrigerator, because LA is just weird like that, and they don't provide fridges for their tenants, and you have to supply your own, which is just, it's weird. It's ridiculous.
Cameron and Mark basically pulled Denver out of a hat. They arrived there without much of a plan, much as they did in Los Angeles. But this time, they chose a city where it's not as expensive to live. Instead of $1,600 to $2,000 rent per month, they're looking at $1,200 to $1,500. And unlike LA, the rental market was far less competitive.
Well, we just found out that we were approved for a place. Thank God.
We finally found a place. It was beginning to be soul crushing.
It's going to take a couple months to rebuild, not as long as LA because it was just so expensive out there for rent and whatnot, but rent is a lot more feasible here, and you know, gas is pretty cheap, food isn't expensive.
It feels good knowing that that we won't be living in a hotel for very much longer.
Yeah, living out of our bags.
Well, not that we have much more than what's in our bags.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
They both were able to start working at a pizza place almost as soon as they arrived. That and some loans from friends and relatives got them started. But they didn't have any family in Denver. Not a lot of friends either. So in the coming weeks and months, loneliness set in. It weighed them down and ate away at their motivation to follow their entertainment dreams. Mark recorded an update again 2 months later in late November.
So it's Saturday. Just kind of doing some cleaning around the house. Thanksgiving was just a couple days ago.
I don't think either of us, it had really hit us as hard as it did maybe like in the days leading up to Thanksgiving. Just kind of how alone and tired we are. It's been kind of tough, to be honest. I didn't think I would miss people back home this much, and we were talking on Thanksgiving morning about how just a little over 2 months ago we were on a collision course with becoming homeless. This Thanksgiving, we were just really thankful to have a home and to not be sleeping on the ground in our home anymore, and the fact that we have a couch.
Mark and Cameron did make plans to create a new theater company in Denver. They even talked to friends back home who were really interested in coming to join them, which was encouraging. But unfortunately, it just didn't stick. The day-to-day scramble to stay afloat financially took its toll.
By the time we got here, we were so far behind, owed so many people money, that we just had to constantly work. We couldn't take any jobs that allowed us any time off to be able to go and explore those routes of auditioning for different shows or going and doing stand-up.
I'm an artist. If I'm not creating something, you know, I start to just get really, really on edge and anxious, and I gotta have outlets to, you know, express myself. It's like a form of therapy for me, you know, so.
Not getting to be creative led to some depression. Depression made keeping a job a harder task. Cameron went from delivering pizzas to selling phones. Mark went through several jobs over the course of a few months. Pizza, UPS, a solar startup, a deli. And none of it really provided a living wage.
I have $9 on a credit card. Cameron has a maxed out credit card and one debit card that's in the red and another that's got a zero balance.
It would be nice to report that things got better or easier, that Mark and Cameron find their footing, but that's not what happens next. Not yet. First, things had to get worse.
Like, I've never kind of been in a situation where I hoped somebody OD'd, but I don't know if I could take another suicide.
That's next time. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Glynis Board. Thank you.
You can hear the last installment of Mark Combs' Struggle to Stay story in 2 weeks right here on Inside Appalachia. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, you can help others discover the podcast by simply rating the podcast and writing a review. And thanks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear from another West Virginian artist who left Appalachia, the guitarist for the Martinsburg band Roswell Kid. But as he discovered, leaving home wasn't easy, and there are still some things he misses about West Virginia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
We're the best of friends. We're sharing all the things that we hold dear. Trading comic books and action figures and Ninja Turtle gear.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Bill Withers, Brad Paisley, Tim O'Brien, these are just a few of the music superstars who hail from the Mountain State. But there's plenty more talent hidden within the West Virginia hills and hollers. That's what our own Joni Deutsch intends to show. All this month, a Change of Tune's 30 Days of West Virginia Music series features interviews with 30 people who help make our state's music scene wild and wonderful. The first artist featured this year is Wood County, West Virginia native Adam Meisterhands. Meisterhands splits his time producing records in Nashville and touring the world with the Martinsburg, West Virginia band, Roswell Kid.
Was it a hard thing to start up in Shepherdstown, like this kind of alt-rock, punk-rock kind of band? Because right now, I'm not really sure the Shepherdstown scene, beyond Roswell Kid, in a way, cultivates that kind of music.
Well, I mean, the Shepherdstown scene, I guess, is more or less just sort of a combination of whoever's in college at that time and then townies and people that are just kind of still here, I guess. So it's an interesting scene, but it's not necessarily the great place for a band to kind of graduate from being a band of your friends in college to being like a band that can actually like get out and tour and do the things you have to do to like keep being a band. So it wasn't hard to start it, and it wasn't hard to be in that band like around this area, but it was sort of hard to get to a next level where it was like we could afford to keep the wheels on the road. So we just kind of toured regionally. And so, yeah, I mean, because there wasn't, like, a huge scene here, I mean, basically you could play at the pizza place, you know. You can only play the pizza place so much, you know. And that's nothing against the pizza place. It's just, it's the supply and demand, I guess.
How was it when you first moved down to Nashville as a West Virginian? Was it a bit of a culture shock musically and life-wise?
It wasn't a culture shock. It's just hard to move anywhere, you know. I had never lived in a city, you know. I went from Washington Bottom, West Virginia, to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, which, you know, is about pretty similar in terms of, like, number of people. So, you know, it was the first time I lived in a city. I didn't have any money. I didn't know that many people. So there were a lot of ways in which it sucked. And then there were also a lot of ways where it was incredibly exciting because I was around world-class musicians for free there. You know, just whatever you want to tip them, essentially. Which is crazy, you know. You can go see Kenny Vaughn play for $3, and he's obviously should get more than $3, but that was what I had at the time. So, like, but you can go experience people playing at a level that I had never really encountered before. And so it's a mix of, like, the normal things that are hard about moving to a new place, but also countered with an incredibly inspiring experience of being around people that could do things that I had never seen before. So, you know, as a guitar player, as a musician, it sharpens you and it makes you want to go home and practice, and it makes you want to try and just better yourself in whatever way you can. So it was a combination of things. You know, I didn't have a job for a while when I lived there, and the job I did have eventually was substitute teaching, which was trying. So it was hard, but I mean, moving anywhere is hard, and it gets easier, and you get to know more people, get more ingratiated into the scene, I suppose.
That was Adam Meisterhans, who plays in the alt-rock band Roswell Kid, speaking with Joni Deutsch, host of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Saturday Night Music Show, A Change of Tune. You can hear more from her series, 30 Days of West Virginia Music, on our website at wvpublic.org. It's the time of year for summer camps, and maybe you remember going to summer camp or vacation Bible school as a kid. For this next story, we'll travel back in time to hear a story about a small mountain community of young people during the 1950s who challenged the idea that blacks and whites should exist separately. The history of the civil rights movement is generally told in terms of big, dramatic events like the Montgomery bus boycott or the Freedom Rides. Less well known is a history of quiet, grassroots activism that worked toward the same goals. One such effort was an integrated day camp that began in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1950. Beth Bingman, who attended the camp as a child, sent us this story from WMMT in Kentucky.
Oh, grandmother was involved in anything that involved civil rights. I mean, grandpapa too, but grandmother was way more active. And obviously somebody mentioned that, and it was about integration, and of course she's going to be in favor of that. And as I said, the bus came by and picked us up.
The bus that picked up young Nikki Giovanni took her to Fellowship House Day Camp, a summer program in Knoxville, Tennessee that began in 1950 and continued until 1972. The camp was initiated by a small group of Knoxville women, including Giovanni's grandmother, who wanted to create an atmosphere for children in which they may develop understanding and appreciation of their neighbors here in the community and in the whole great wide world. I went to the day camp, too. I do remember that the camp was racially integrated. It seemed natural enough as a child, but looking back on it, I realized that this was very unusual for that time and place. Over the past couple of years, I've been seeking out people who might remember Fellowship House Day Camp. One of these was Gid Fryer, camp director in 1951.
So it was actually a knockoff of the Vacation Bible School. So while the Baptists were having Vacation Bible Schools, Fellowship House was having the equivalent without the Bible.
My memory must be of one of the first ones, because I remember a road going up to it that was dirt, that was clay. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was very woodsy around, mm-hmm. and my impression it was on that side of town on the outskirts, and I don't know what the name of it was, but I just really remember a lot of children and arts and crafts.
Oh, our daily routine would have been assembly, devotion. And then we had classes. We had teachers, and then they had crafts, and then they had actual sports. We did camping trips, and the camping was just like being in a Boy Scout troop. You know, we weren't learning how to make knots and stuff like that, but we were learning how to build campfires, how to cook over the fire, that type of thing. How to do a backpack and sleeping bag, the things that you use for camping.
I remember the counselors, we did a lot of singing. We sang a lot of camp songs.
Silly songs
and rounds and John Jacob Jingleheimer Schmidt.
Oh, yes.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Those kind of things.
Of course, they swam. They loved to swim because many of them didn't have that opportunity at home. Mm-hmm. and didn't get around to the parks. And we had, and because I did the music part in the camping where I worked, we had a big emphasis on singing. So we did lots of camp songs and what have you. And then we did arts and crafts, you know, craft work, lanyards. And then nature. We had big emphasis on nature because we were at Kalkowen Park. We were in the woods, you know. Okay. So we did a big part of the camp day on nature.
We heard from camp counselor Sherby Jones, former campers David Turk and Mary Hook, and from Lois White, camp director from 1968 to 1972.
We didn't have problems. We were children. We had fun. If it was a social experiment, it was in their minds. But whatever it was successful because the camp grew.
The staff was aware that they were undertaking something that might have been a bit risky. Many of the organizers were members of the Unitarian Church in Knoxville, and this congregation had received threats when they accepted their first black member. Dick Henry was the Unitarian minister when the camp was started.
They began out of a desire to have really important, significant program for the kids, and they were not going to have any questions asked about race. All comers would be welcome, and they were eager to have a cross-racial group of folks intentionally integrated. And there was a little hush-hushness about it as it got going. I remember thinking, well, we're off here in the mountains and they won't find us.
Ruth Martin, camp director in 1957 and 1958, described an incident on the way to taking campers to the Smokies.
We stopped to buy gas. And, of course, you know, when you go get gas, you also do these other things. And so the girls immediately left the car to go to the bathroom. So they were gone from the car when the attendant got back. And he said, well, where are the girls? And I said, well, they've gone off to the bathroom. Oh! You know, that was just to him a terrifying idea that they would go to the white bathroom. Mm-hmm. So he got really livid and said, you know, when did they leave and when will they be back? And I remember just dragging my feet about it. We just loitered along, and pretty soon I saw the girls were coming slowly back from the bathroom, and that all was taken care of. We didn't think of ourselves as very, very brave, just a little maybe, because it just wasn't the way you did things back then. We were not flaming liberals at all. We would go along with the quiet Smoke way of getting things accomplished.
Well, what I remember, it was a fun camp to go through and go to, not through, and it was interracial. And as I recall, it's probably my first experience in any kind of interracial situation like that. And I think, as I say, the interracial part of it, that was a very progressive thing for the time, because, you know, being in a segregated society in the mid-50s, there wasn't hardly any interaction for children or adults. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of like, I think, an experiment to see how it would work, and, you know, didn't have any problems.
Your level of understanding is better. You grow up with more. You're more open. It wasn't like the Civil Rights March on Washington. It was not that. Excuse me, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't politically charged or anything like that. For the kids, it was a good summer, a good multicultural experience. Mm-hmm. I have to say that.
For the adults, the organization of the camp and the subsequent organization of Fellowship House led to other activities working for racial justice in Knoxville.
Well, yeah, that was, Fellowship House fostered opportunities for interaction between blacks and whites. So it was an anti-segregation group, and the opportunities were not extensive in Knoxville at that time for interracial fellowship.
Fellowship House members, many of whom were camp parents or staff, were involved in efforts to integrate the University of Tennessee, Knoxville healthcare facilities, and the Knoxville City Schools. In 1960, students from historically black Knoxville College, the site of the day camp beginning in 1957, began to sit in at downtown Knoxville lunch counters. Fellowship House members joined them, as did Harry Wiersema, a former camper and junior counselor.
My parents sent me to fellowship camp. They sent me to a church that was integrated. I had black friends in Sunday school. And then, when I come back from working in steel mill on engineering co-op program, my mother and my father, now my father's real energetic. My mother was always, always had a headache and always sickly. But she was down there at noon getting bug spray sprayed in her face from the people at the lunch counter. And my dad was doing all that and risking his job. And I didn't go through any training. I just showed up. I just found out where the sit-ins were, and I showed up. Because I'd absorbed all that.
I think it did have impact on the town because even though it wasn't, I don't think it was something just highly publicized, it wasn't a secret either. And I think that it helped people to know that, well, the races can do something together, especially young people and children. So I think that had a good historical impact, in my opinion, that these walls of separation are coming down and you see an experiment going forward. So I think it had a ripple effect.
Former camper Daniel Brown is in a position to know about the ripple effect the day camp may have had. He's on the Knoxville City Council and served as Knoxville's first African-American mayor. Nikki Giovanni put the importance of remembering and telling these stories in a different way.
And, I think everybody appreciates the fact that, and she was not alone, all of those women. You know, that's what I'm saying. I think that working with the 70-year-olds is important because we're letting a lot of little stories that nobody thinks amount to much, but when you start to put them all together, you see how cities were changed because of women like my grandmother, you know.
That was writer Nikki Giovanni reflecting on the Knoxville Fellowship House Day Camp. This radio feature was produced with support from the Appalachian Sound Archives Fellowship Project at Berea College. For WMMT, I am Beth Bingman.
When we come back, we'll hear about two of Appalachia's biggest industries historically. We'll check in with some folks in a coal town and a timber town to see how things have changed. That's coming up next, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. During his campaign for president, Donald Trump pledged to bring back jobs in blue-collar type industries, especially in coal mining. That message helped him gain support in central Appalachia. And though other industries like solar are hiring at a rapid pace across the country, the renewable energy industry doesn't provide as many jobs in Appalachia as in other regions. So what does this all mean for laid-off miners looking for work? The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with some miners who are looking to stay in Appalachia and what they're hoping for in the future.
At CONSOL Energy's Harvey Mine, about an hour south of Pittsburgh, Craig Williams takes a midday break above ground in a big room at the mine's entrance. He's in a hard hat and he's wearing a dusty, yellow-striped mining jacket. Though times have been tough in the coal industry, Williams and other miners here have managed to keep their jobs. He hopes to hang on to his job as a foreman.
You know, Pittsburgh used to be a big on steel. That's mostly gone now. We're one of the last, industries around, and hope to keep it that way.
A father of two, he says, like generations before him, Cole is the best way he's able to support his family. Williams wouldn't say how much he's making, but nationwide, coal miners make around $80,000 a year.
If you had to take another job in this area especially, you're going to take anywhere from a 50 to a 70% pay cut to what the next best thing is that's out there.
But 40% of coal mining jobs have disappeared since 2011, and now only 50,000 of these jobs remain. Experts say automation, lower demand for electricity, and above all, competition from cheaper fuels are what's killing the industry. Those fuels include natural gas from fracking and increasingly renewable energy. Solar power now accounts for just under 1.5% of electricity in the U.S. But according to the Department of Energy, solar jobs now outnumber those in coal by more than 2-to-1. So, can laid-off coal miners find jobs in solar?
Well, certainly it's a possibility, but there are a couple of major challenges.
Rob Godby is an energy economist at the University of Wyoming. He says one of those challenges is simple: location.
When you are thinking about coal mining in Appalachia, I mean, oftentimes there are generations of families in those regions, and it's just very difficult to pick up and move.
And then there's pay. Coal miners make on average around $35 an hour, Godby says, in part because the job can be so dangerous. In renewables, the pay is more like $20 or $25 an hour.
That doesn't mean you couldn't raise a family on that, but you're a lot closer to the average income in a lot of states in the solar industry than you are in mining industries.
On a rooftop at a community center in Millvale, just outside of Pittsburgh, a gang of seven workers in neon green T-shirts bolt down solar panels. The crew includes 23-year-old Wiley Kuntz, who worked at a coal mine, though as a lower-paid contractor. When he got laid off last year, he saw a job opening with Energy Independent Solutions, a local solar company.
I didn't like just mentally be like, I'm just going to completely switch. It just was a coincidence. I just found this job, and it was about the same pay rate that I was making before, so I just went for it, ended up really liking it.
One thing that did not weigh on his decision, climate change.
I don't really believe in the whole climate change thing or not. It's good, it does, it takes the carbon, for sure. It's a lot less, and it's a lot cleaner energy.
But a steady paycheck, and not necessarily the environment, is what attracted him to the job. Kuntz says he likes the problem solving he gets to do in solar, and he could see himself staying in the industry. Brian Krenzelak was a roofer before joining the company 7.5 years ago. Krenzelak installs solar and trains others, and he believes in the mission of green energy. His wife also works, and the couple have 3 kids, one in college with another about to enter. They even have a second home in Florida.
You know, I do well with this company, very well. It covers what we need to cover. I mean, I'm not becoming a millionaire overnight, but steadily have been building the nest egg for sure.
Experts say solar's boom is being helped by incentives that are scheduled to run out in a few years, and they don't know how long the surge in business will last. Some companies are reporting lower installations nationwide, but solar jobs in Pennsylvania grew last year by almost a quarter. And Krenzelak's company, Energy Independent Solutions, is busy. It's looking to basically double its workforce of 22 over the next year and a half.
We had to slow the salesmen down at a certain point. We were selling so much solar, we had to actually slow them down a little bit till we caught up.
Krenzelak likes the idea that his industry is up and coming. He says when his crew went on a big installation recently, other contractors were curious about what they do.
So there was iron workers there, carpenters, union laborers. Everyone's coming up to us.
He says it feels like solar is an industry of the future. And when he looks into the future, he likes what he sees. For The Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Like coal, the timber industry also historically provided a living for many people in certain areas of Appalachia.
But jobs declined. The timber industry has seen a resurgence in recent years as demand for hardwoods has grown in the U.S. and abroad. But the industry has changed a lot over the past 100 years. Independent producer Gene Snedeker takes a look at the history of West Virginia's forests, starting before the timber industry began.
Just as we came to the hills, we met with a sycamore of a most extraordinary size. It measuring 3 feet from the ground, 45 feet around, lacking 2 inches, and not 50 yards from it was another, 31 feet around. George Washington, written while exploring the Great Kanawha River, November 4th, 1770.
Washington's description of the virgin forest that covered most of West Virginia is one of the few early written accounts we have. We do know that the trees were huge and that the vast forest canopy was often unbroken, making it dark underneath. But there were exceptions. Native Americans used fires to make clearings for agriculture. And in the late 1700s and early 1800s, European settlers built iron ore smelters or furnaces in the forest, according to Joe McNeil, professor of forestry at West Virginia University.
They needed iron to make things that would be durable, tools and weapons, and iron was a valuable commodity. And so they would go out and they would find iron nuggets or iron ore deposits, and they would dig trenches to acquire the iron ore. And then they'd have to smelt it. And so they would build these large iron ore smelters, and they would use coal, but they also used a lot of wood. And so over a long period of time, you had them cutting the trees down to serve as fuel for the smelters.
I've come to the Stewart Recreation Area outside Elkins, part of the Monongahela National Forest. This woodland was last logged more than 100 years ago. I'm with Don Teeter, a surveyor and local historian.
This tree's a red oak, very impressive size. I'm going to stretch the diameter tape around it. We have a diameter of almost 44 inches on this tree. Now, the diameter is measured, generally speaking, 4.5 feet from the ground. It's called DBH, or diameter at breast height, and that's the standard measurement that's used in the timber industry. This is the sort of tree that would excite a logger.
Within a relatively short walk through the woodland, we see large specimens of red oak, black oak, white oak, scarlet oak, chestnut oak, eastern hemlock, yellow poplar, beech, red maple, and black cherry. But Teeter reminded me that before the period of major industrialization in the United States, most of the timber in West Virginia was relatively worthless, except to build your house or a barn or a fence.
When the early settlers first got to this area, the forest was actually an impediment to them, because there was no market for the logs. The trees would keep the ground from being able to produce the grass that they needed to raise livestock. It would keep the sun from being able to reach the ground for them to grow crops. So what they did a lot of times was what was called hacking or deadening, where they would girdle the trees. They would cut through the bark on a strip, maybe 4 to 8 inches wide near the stump of the tree, so that the tree would die. And then, of course, once the tree died and you didn't have the thick foliage up there, the sun could make it down through. And gradually over the years, then they would clear the stumps out of the fields.
But the beginning of an intense period of industrialization in the United States meant that West Virginia's ancient forest was about to disappear. Joe McNeil again.
Prior to the end of the 19th century, going into the 20th, we saw this huge swath of the Appalachian forest cut down. And places like Dolly Sods were dramatically affected. I mean, their entire ecology was affected by the harvesting and then the aftermath of burning and reburning and then reburning again.
Between 1879 and 1920, there was a great logging boom. During this period, devastating logging practices and fires removed almost all of the old-growth forest in West Virginia. 30 billion board feet of timber was cut down. Don Teeter says that in the early days, logging was mostly done along rivers, so companies could float the logs to sawmills.
But the real decimation, you could say, of the forest in a lot of areas could not occur until we had the logging railroads, when you could punch those railroads up into all the little hollows and you could reach all of the trees. And the Shea-geared locomotive, the Heisler, and the Climax locomotives were critical in that, because they could be used on a grade that was much steeper than other railroad engines could use, and you could have also sharper curves. It was like an all-wheel drive vehicle today. But tremendous power in those engines and the ability to remove large loads from the woods.
But cutting down that much forest in a relatively short time had some pretty horrific consequences. Fires burned large areas, including logging boom towns. After the surrounding forest was cut down, many of those towns disappeared altogether. In addition, there was devastating soil erosion, flooding, and degraded water quality. So in 1911, Congress passed the Weeks Act, which led to the establishment of many eastern national forests, including the Monongahela National Forest, which today covers more than 900,000 acres across 10 counties in West Virginia. Soon after, professional foresters started managing forests to protect wildlife and waterways and to try to maximize the many assets of the forest. Over the next few decades, the forests across West Virginia began to recover. Today, West Virginia boasts 12 million acres of forest, much of which is harvested on a regular basis. Forestry professor Joe McNeil again.
When somebody cuts a stand of timber down, it's not gone forever. If you leave a field just sitting, over time, it becomes a forest again. We've had a variety of harvests across the state, and yet right now there's a huge amount of timberland that exists in the state. Almost 80% of our state, in terms of area, is forested. We've not cut like we used to. So don't be terrified when you see somebody cutting timber down. Go find out what you can about it. I think the other thing I would say is that our forests are renewable. They do come back, sometimes even when you don't want them to. So that would be what I would leave you with.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Jean Snediger.
That story was made possible with funding from the Miles Family Foundation. This summer, wherever the road takes you, maybe to the beach for a breather, or to the Monongahela National Forest for a hike or a summer job, or maybe just to your front porch with a glass of iced tea, listening to crickets, or catching up on some podcasts, I hope you'll send us a message and let us know how you're spending the summer. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front, the Ohio Valley Resource, and WMMT. Music in today's show was provided by Roswell Kid, Marisa Anderson, Dinosaur Burps, Andy Agnew Jr., and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd produced the show. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Claire Hemme helped with our digital correspondence. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, or at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.